Explosions on the Nord Stream pipelines raise questions of sabotage. This is Brief Before Impact. Hey, welcome everyone. I am Matt Parker and thank you for joining me. No doubt you've heard or seen news of the recent explosions and damage to the Nord Stream 1 and 2 pipelines. These are gas pipelines running from Russia into Europe. We're going to answer the questions of, number one, what happened? Secondly, what are the vulnerabilities to these critical pipelines, including both gas and communication cables running throughout the world? And lastly, what is the future of energy security in Europe? But before we get into that, let me take a quick ad break, then we will get to work. Welcome back, everyone. So let's break down, first of all, what actually happened in the recent weeks. According to Stanley Reed from the New York Times, he writes that three separate leaks were discovered in two giant natural gas pipelines from Russia. The pipelines were filled with the fuel, and the ruptures produced gas bubbles half a mile wide that rose to the surface of the Baltic Sea near the Danish island of Bornholm. Explosions had been detected nearby just before the leaks occurred, and European governments have not yet identified the cause of the leaks in the pipelines, known as Nord Stream 1 and Nord Stream 2. Political leaders in Europe and the United States have suggested that the incident was an act of sabotage. Speculation has pointed to Russia, whose state-controlled energy company, Gazprom, is the main owner of the pipelines. A spokesman for President Vladimir Putin of Russia, Dmitry Peskov, has dismissed these allegations of Russian involvement as, quote, stupid, and pointed a finger at the United States. The pipelines are built of steel, coated with concrete, so that they can withstand the underwater pressures. In other words, it takes a lot of force to damage them. The head of Danish Energy Agency, Mr. Butzow, has said, quote, a gas leak of this nature is extremely rare. It is unlikely that three gas leaks would occur in one accident within 24 hours. Swedish seismologists have detected two separate underwater explosions near where the leaks were later identified. Both lines of Nord Stream 1 were damaged, whereas only one of Nord Stream's two lines were ruptured, which means that, at least theoretically, gas could flow through the second line. So this is a quick overview of what actually happened with these explosions. And that's kind of the basics right now. As you can imagine, I think the number I heard or read was that these pipelines are 70 meters deep. So let's just make that around 200 feet or so. So to get down and make an investigation at these levels will take a little bit of time in coordination between the naval powers that operate in the Baltic Sea. While that ongoing investigation is happening, certainly speculation has risen of whether this was actually some kind of man-made sabotage attempt. But what I wanted to provide you tonight was a little more depth on what these pipelines are beyond just how they transport natural gas from Russia into Europe, but what are the states or globally of these types of gas pipelines and optic cables that allow essentially nonstop communication and the transfer of energy to happen between nation states. So I'm going to give you the outline of the pipelines as they exist and mentioning how their vulnerabilities. According to John Lysister for the Associated Press, gas networks form just part of the globe's dense mesh of undersea pipes and cables that power economies, keep houses warm, and connect billions of people. More than 1.3 million kilometers, that's about 800,000 miles, of fiber optic cables, more than enough to stretch to the moon and back, span the ocean and the seas, according to telegeography, which tracks and maps the vital communication networks. The cables are typically the width of a garden hose, but 97% of the world's communication, including trillions of dollars of financial transactions, pass through these cables each day. Without them, modern life could suddenly freeze, economies would crash, and governments would struggle to communicate with each other and their troops. according to British lawmaker Rishi Sunak, has warned in a 2017 report, laying out the risk before he became the UK's Treasury chief. Power cables also run underwater. Lithuania alleged in 2015 that a Russian naval ship repeatedly tried to hinder the laying of an undersea power cable linking the country to Sweden. Lithuania's energy minister was quoted as saying he regarded Russia's actions as hostile. So how vulnerable are these cables? Well, the gas pipeline blast showed that the striking seabed infrastructure and escaping seemingly undetected is possible, even in the crowded Baltic Sea. Relatively shallow, with lots of maritime traffic and unexploded bombs on its floor from the both world wars, the sea is viewed as a challenge to navigate undetected. Even the Kremlin agreed it seemed unlikely to be the work of amateurs. Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov said, quote, "It looks like a terror attack, probably conducted on a state level." Dozens of breakages each year to submarine communication cables, often caused by fishing vessels and anchors, testify to their fragility. Their locations on the seafloor aren't secret. They're not robustly protected by international law, and it doesn't take vast expertise or resources to damage them. Again, that's according to Sunak's report. Torben Ording Jorgensen, a retired admiral with the Danish Navy, has said that our infrastructure is fragile. In regards to the Baltic gas leaks, this has sharpened our attention on these vulnerabilities, being the internet, power cables, or gas pipes. So what really can be done now that we've laid out these vulnerabilities? Again, according to Leicester, writing that after the Cold War, nations in the NATO military alliance shrank their anti-submarine warfare forces, trimming defense budgets and judging the threat from Russia diminished. The, quote, "the ability of many Western nations to reliably detect, track, deter, and counter Russian undersea activities has atrophied," said a 2016 study. Undersea warfare in Northern Europe, that was led then by Kathleen Hicks, now is the number two at the U.S. Defense Department. Again, retired French Vice Admiral Olga Harry, a former head of France's Center of Higher Military Studies, has said that Western nations have, quote, "allowed themselves to fall asleep," and that they must now throw themselves into better protecting undersea cables and pipes that Russia has identified as both vital and vulnerable. So, as speculations rise, I think we can all make the point that this is a critical part of our infrastructure that we may have totally undervalued in its importance, or its importance in how our economies work and just, you know, our daily lives. Transporting the communications between communication cables between Europe and the United States, certainly pipelines between North and Central Asia over to European customers. These pipelines and cables have tremendous impact on just how modern life is conducted. And as this report has laid out, they're quite vulnerable to any type of attack, especially in the instance of whenever a leader with the capability and the intent finds himself or herself into a corner that requires such aggressive behavior. Now, I certainly won't try to point my finger at who it is, because there's just not enough data at this time, and I'm not going to speculate. But I will say what we can observe is that this was a sophisticated attack. Even if it was rather simple in its execution, it took a quite an impressive capability to pull it off. And the wherewithal, the financing, the training to do so, it's nothing to be less than impressive, to say the least. Now, the question I think that's really ruminating, it's we understand the significance of pipelines, but what in fact is Europe's energy future when it comes to energy security? Now, Nord Stream, again, this is according to Kenneth Razopa. He's writing for Forbes. Nord Stream is probably good as gone. Next up will be Russian gas transit through Ukraine, which is still ongoing, but is likely the next shoe to drop. However, that happens remains to be seen, and gas transit fees are around 8% of Ukraine's GDP. There is a risk that European leaders and the U.S. will assume Russian sabotage, and that will stop the trickle of natural gas still flowing into Western Europe as Russia just retaliates by shutting down what little they are shipping now. Ukraine, which has also blamed the Kremlin for the incident, would be impacted as gas is still flowing through the Naftogaz pipe, which is Ukraine's state-owned energy conglomerate. It is arguably the most important company in Ukraine. Naftogaz and Gazprom have been at each other's throats for around 10 years with high legal bills on both sides. Their fight has been a key starting point in the Russia-Ukraine divorce. Europe has failed miserably at mediating that divorce. Now Russia and Europe are divorcing in what will some might compare to a new Cold War between the West and Russia. Will Europe come out okay is the question. And their reliance on Russian fuel resources is legion. And in a note today, Raymond James and an energy analyst, Pavel Malkinov, said that the EU's natural gas storage is looking better. It is currently up at 88% of total capacity, with a month to go before the heating season begins to fill up even more. The UK, who's now led by Prime Minister Liz Truss, is back to fracking for hydrocarbons. A good market signal, but won't shift the supply equation in the near term. Now, Malkinov said, quote, "There is no longer any reason for Europeans to worry about physical gas shortages this winter," end quote. The record high cost of imported gas, as distinct from physical access to supply, it's still an economic challenge, Malkinov says, but it's manageable as governments absorb much of the immediate burden on their sovereign balance sheets. The bottom line is that Europe has managed to successfully disentangle from Gazprom more rapidly than anyone could have imagined at the start of this war. So whenever I think about this, looking at the importance of pipelines, and I want to make sure everyone grasps that, Nord Stream 1 and Nord Stream 2 were non-operational pipelines. So, for example, Nord Stream 1 has been around for a while. However, it was in the gases that were in the pipelines at that time, especially after the invasion of Russia into Ukraine, had become what they call latent gas. So it wasn't pushing the same natural gas that it had been in the past into Europe. So, secondly, Nord Stream 2, it was actually what was considered undergoing commissioning operations, which is another way of saying it was just in testing. So this is like a testing gas that was actually we see escaping into the Baltic Sea. So let me put that first out there. These are two non-operational pipelines. So what would be the benefit of doing so? What would be the benefit of creating a sabotage operation against two non-operational pipelines? Well, if we're looking at it from Russia's perspective, you could argue that Russia laid explosives on these pipelines in order to, say, create like a false flag operation, meaning they could say, well, yeah, someone did blow up these pipelines. I bet it was Ukraine or, you know, one of its Western allies. Doing this just to churn up uncertainty, that uncertainty both geopolitically between allies, as well as even uncertainty in the energy markets. Now, another reason that Russia might have launched such a sabotage operation, as if we've already seen what they could be saying now, as kind of playing off of that, we'll say, yeah, we'd love to help repair these pipelines. We don't know who did it, but if you do want our help, we're going to have Western economic sanctions lifted in order for us to fix this damage. So there's another key reason that Russia may have been to blame that we don't still know yet. And I think when you tie all this together, the vulnerabilities of these pipelines, the fact that Europe, since the invasion of Russia into Ukraine, has pivoted dramatically, looking for other suppliers or energy sources, that still has taken time. And they still do, in fact, depend on Russian gas. And so as the EU is working quickly to find other suppliers for their energy needs, it does take time to build out the infrastructure. And so when you look at unexpected incidences like the Nord Stream 2 or the Nord Stream pipeline's explosions, it looks like the next step that one of the reports I mentioned articulated is that Russia is already even now threatening to cut off gas through Ukraine. Again, attempt to undermine Western solidarity. And not only are like the technology sanctions a priority for Russia to be lifted, but also any type of undermining of that Western support for Ukraine that perhaps would lead to even a potential ceasefire. All the while, that would then allow, you know, Putin to, say, refit his 300,000 troops or so, and then, you know, be in a better position if he wanted to attack yet again. Again, there are all these different weights on the side and the scale of the Russia narrative. I can't say if I'm 100% confident that's the case. Eventually, the truth will come out on what the explosions, or who caused the explosions, and we'll have a far better understanding than why that was the case. But no matter what the leading cause or and who was responsible for it at this time to be known, what I'm confident in thinking is that these cables, these pipelines, are going to become a more and more important part of national security, both for the United States and for our European allies. And I see this kind of consideration being played out in other parts of the world. Everyone's focused on Russia and Ukraine. But really, think about it like you're in a laboratory and scientists are conducting experiments. We're all looking at the Russian-Ukraine experiment. Now, imagine yourself as a leader of a nation. You're watching this experiment going on, and then you're taking away those lessons on how it might affect your end state and your part of the world, your region, and your enemies that you're, you know, fighting against. Think about it that way. You're taking lessons learned from this one experiment you're all observing, then you're going back home and thinking about how you can apply them to your situation. Ultimately, from the United States perspective, I think we will continue to have to play a bigger role and a role of leadership when it comes to addressing these national security issues that are both regional all throughout the world and domestic here at the United States, and how we can continue to remove those vulnerabilities of our, in this example, of our own energy security. So I hope you enjoyed this episode. More to come on this subject, especially as investigations roll out and we learn more about the potential causes and the individuals or countries that we can lay blame to. As always, I hope you're picking up what I'm putting down. I am Matt Parker, and this is Brief Before Impact.